Hey, it's Steve Imke. In the fall of 2016, I had an opportunity to spend two nights with a class full of hobbyists that wanted to learn how to take a hobby that they love and turn it into a viable business. During those two nights, I took them on a journey of business entrepreneurship. I'm sorry you didn't make it, and I hope this is the next best thing. Here are excerpts from that live event. Hope you enjoy it. But even more important, I hope it inspires you to get off the couch and do something with it. Thanks for listening. Okay, so remember first we had the financial go, no go. If we couldn't raise the money, it really wasn't worth moving forward. So now we're sitting there saying, okay, we could raise the money. Now we've just done some market stuff. Is the market big enough? How big is it? How many competitors do I actually have in the marketplace? And can I actually stimulate them? That kind of stuff. And so now we've made the decision to kind of move to the next level. So the next piece is kind of where we get into the planning process, the business planning, which is what most people kind of think about. And so what we're going to talk about is there's really two real basic ways to apply this today. And one of them is what I'll call the traditional business planning, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And then the other one is this business model canvas, and we'll kind of really drive into that one a little bit more first. So, well, you can start. Now, it starts out with nine boxes, and I may or may not add some of the other external boxes as we kind of go through there. It kind of depends on time and how we kind of go there. But essentially, these are all the things that you want to control as part of your planning process. And quite frankly, you can actually, if you go to my blog there, you can actually download an electronic version of this. And there's even little sticky pads on the bottom that you can drag up and type in and do whatever else you want to do. Or you can print it out and just scribble on it yourself. But it's meant to run many iterations of the same business model several times, hence the business model canvas. It's on one sheet of paper, so it's not like all these different pages. It's just kind of notes about things. Now, the typical way that people would approach this, and you can approach it from any one of the blocks as you go in there, but the most common way is to look at the customer segment first. Who is the customer who's going to go buy this? How old are they? Is there a gender relationship there? Are they wealthy? Are they not? Is it divided on a variety of different demographic kinds of parameters? And then, of course, the next one is we even can go into some of the psychographic things to kind of get in there. And we kind of talked a little bit about, you know, the Harley-Davidson history and the demand curves and all that other kind of stuff that kind of factors in a little bit here. So we want to find out who the customer is. Who is the customer that's most likely going to go ahead and use that? And we're going to talk a little bit about all these in a few seconds as we drill down there. So just kind of memorize this picture here. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about customer segments, and we're going to look at the value proposition. And then once we understand the value proposition, we're going to figure out how we can get this value proposition to the customer segment. What are the channels that we're going to use to get it there? And what is the relationship that that customer expects to have from us? And then we're going to look at revenue streams of how we're going to make money, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. And when I say when we come up with just that portion of it, now's maybe the time to do a little bit of testing out there to verify some of those assumptions. Remember those leap of faith assumptions that we've made out there, so we can put something out there, whether it's that three-page website that we talked about or something like that. Maybe it's even just taking a poll. We did a class here at Pikes Peak this summer. It was a total immersion entrepreneurship program, and we basically gave the students, after they came up with an idea, basically a sheet, and then they literally went out into public and just interviewed people on the street and said, how do you feel about this, and how would you do that? And so however you do that, however you gather that information, it's a good point to do that at this point. Because then you would go to the next portion right here where we identify key activities, resources, cost structures, and partners. And then we'll look at the outside of that. So the next couple pieces here, we'll kind of talk about each one of these as they go in there. So right here, customer segment, right? For whom are we creating value? I mean, who are the people going to get that? And who are the most important customers? So examples of these things are things like a mass market. Is that where we're going after? Or are we going after a very tiny niche market? So if we're building quilts, and maybe we want to focus on just wedding quilts, some of the things we talked about near the end of the workshop, that may be that very small niche. We may be talking about segmented markets or diversified markets, as well as multi-sided platforms. Multi-sided platform would be something along the lines of Amazon. So it has buyers, sellers, that it kind of brings together both processes. eBay is probably another good example of that, where they don't really do anything themselves. All they do is they have people who want to sell stuff and people who want to buy stuff, and they just act as the middle person there. And then you have segmented and diversified, and you can think about that as if I had... I might be a shoe manufacturer, but I might be, you know, focus on athletic shoes as opposed to dress shoes or something like that. Does that make sense to you? Or it might be a sporting goods place where I just kind of focus on anything sporting goods kind of a thing, all right? So that's how we kind of define it. So you look at that piece in there, and I will say that if you go again to my blog post and you type in some of this stuff, you can get all this information, you get a whole narrative, a whole paper on each and every one of these particular things, and tells you how you go through their questions you need to ask yourself and a lot of other kind of things. But in the interest of trying to get the rest of this done in the next hour and a half or so, it's not you know, not feasible to do that, since it's just one way to actually look at that. But so I would also say that there's actually an ebook there that you can buy as well if you choose to go off and do that. Then next thing, we look at the value proposition. And so typically the value proposition, I should probably, it kind of comes down to, if let's say where I'm doing business to business kind of a thing, or maybe it's business to consumer, what is the jobs that the person does? So if I'm a consumer business, for example, what is it that they try to do? If they cut their grass, okay, that's the job they do. So what do they need to do that? And if it's a business, you get the same part. What's the job that the customer has to ultimately do? What kinds of things gives them pain when they do that? And first of all, what kind of things create, you know, would be a gain for them? So I read an article a number of years ago that talked about the intermittent windshield wiper. Nobody ever asked for an intermittent windshield wiper. Of course, there's always that one Henry Ford, right? He says, if I ever asked anybody what they wanted, they would have just said a faster horse kind of a thing, and he came up with the car. So a lot of times people don't necessarily know enough about a particular industry to know what they're going to get. So, for example, those are the kind of gain things, okay, that you kind of share there. And then, of course, the pain points are the things that everybody has issues with, and everybody has an idea. Not everybody, but I mean, the concept is, you know, this is such a problem. What if we could solve, you know, have something solve that? Okay. So then, of course, if this is the customer profile, then of course the solution is, well, what things can I do to relieve the pains? What kind of things can I create gains that they might not know? So here's where your intermittent windshield wipers might actually go, is in a gain creator, because they would never even ask for that type of a thing. Does that make sense? And then, of course, these then feed into the products and services that you're ultimately going to produce. So to drill down a little bit more, you know, what value do we deliver to the customer? So these are kind of the questions that you need to answer to yourself as you write up your little sticky pad that goes into that little piece there. Which one of our customer problems are we helping to solve? Do we bundle products? Do we break them up? That kind of stuff. And so just soon going right to the back down there, these are general characteristics of a new value proposition. Is it the newness of a particular thing that you're producing? Is it additional performance that you're providing? Is it faster? Is it that kind of stuff? It's got more horsepower if you're selling a car. Is it customizable, where the last one maybe was not very customizable? Now I have the ability to literally go in and design a profile, and now it can be very much toward what I need it to do rather than just a generic piece. Does it, you know, get the job done better? Right? Is it the design that you have? You know, this is the external kind of thing, the aesthetics of it. You know, is there a brand or status that adds to this particular piece? So I just kind of want you to start thinking about the value. This is probably one of the most important pieces of what you're producing that goes out there, and these are just some characteristics of that. You may not have all of those characteristics, but it just kind of gives you some idea of the kinds of things to follow. So the next piece, if you remember, was that little truck thing, the channels. That's we're trying to get the channels. How do we get that value proposition to the customer segment? And in this particular case is you know, basically how do we reach them? So, I mean, it really there's channel phases in here. So how do I get the awareness that I even have this product out there? This is probably one of the biggest nuts that we have to kind of go through right there, you know? So how do we raise awareness about even the fact that we have a product or service for them to do that? I mean, is it going to be through a social media channel? Are we going to use traditional marketing? Some kind of word of mouth? Do we, you know, supercharge that in some other way through coupons or whatever? I mean, you know, or do we get customers to kind of share that? Do we try to create something that's very viral? Those kind of things. And evaluate. How do we help the customer even know that this is, well, better than what choices they actually have? And you can see there's a bit of a cycle here that, you know, you have to have awareness before you can get to the evaluation. And then, you know, how does the person actually purchase the product from me? Is it physically from a point of sale terminal like you might find in a retail outlet, or is it something they enter through a PayPal module online, or how do they actually make the purchase, the delivery? So now they've made the purchase. How do I deliver that? If it's a physical product, do I have to ship it? Do I ship it from my house in the face of a small business where you might be queuing all that stuff up in your garage and shipping it out, or do you actually do a drop ship from something else so you don't even own it? So I mentioned earlier about CreateSpace, for example. So if you ordered one of my paperback books, for example, I don't have an inventory in my garage. So what happens is a demand printer that literally goes out there. You buy one, they print one, and they send it. So I don't even have to get involved in that. So I could be sitting out there in a hunting blind doing something, and you could be ordering a book, and it's fulfilling your order and taking care of all that kind of stuff without me there. Does that make sense? And then so what happens after the sale? What happens if they don't want it and they want to return it, or they got questions about how to use it and so on and so forth? So these are all the different things that you need to answer as part of the channel, how you're going to get that out there. The next piece that we talked about, the customer relationships. What do they expect? And we talked a little bit about the difference between, let's say, a typical shoe store and a Zappos, where, Zappos, when I ordered a pair of boots, they said, hey, no problem. I told them, I said, here's my problem. I'm like generally about 11 and a half wide, but I mean, they don't always fit. And they said, here's the deal. Why don't you go buy an 11, 11 and a half wide, and a 12? And one of those will fit. Just return the other two. That's how they do it. And if you've ever done anything on Zappos, it's their customer service is number one. I mean, that's their mantra. That's their value proposition, what makes them different. But so examples here, is there a personal assistant? Do I physically help you walk you through that process? I mean, we've all bought cars. We might have talked to a salesman who literally goes in there and opens the hood and describes everything that's in there, how all the buttons and everything else work on the car. And then we've done other ones where, personally, I've gone online. I said, I know I wanted to buy that car, and I just go try to find the best price online to go off and do that. Okay, so is it a dedicated personal assistant? Is it self-service? Think about gas stations, right? We used to go in there. They used to have people come out there and pump gas. Now most of them are self-service. Same thing goes for the difference I feel the times when I go into a Home Depot. I don't know whether you notice Home Depot. We always have tradesmen that are in the different departments. So if I'm in electrical and I call the person over to help me, I can ask them a question, and they know a lot about electrical. They're not a plumber. I mean, that's what they are. They're tradesmen that answer those kind of questions. That's a different customer relation model than if I go to Ace Hardware and I get somebody who's just like, well, I just stocked the shelves here. I don't know anything, but here's what our product line is, and, let me read the box, because that's about as good as I have. Does that make sense? So those are two completely different relationships in a very similar kind of business. Is it an automated service, the ebook thing? I mean, people are buying ebooks while I'm sitting here talking to you, or buying books, paperbacks. I don't really do that because it's totally automated. Are there communities? Type of a thing, or co-creation. So you think about YouTube. YouTube's a platform, but YouTube doesn't create any of its own content. People create the content and put it there. Amazon doesn't really create a bunch of, they do have some, but a lot of it is curated from other people who create their own stores and put them on Amazon. So they continue to build that whole model, even though the company doesn't produce anything. So those are the kind of customer relations. And like I said, these are the boxes that we have, and now is probably a good time to test those assumptions. So we talked a little bit about minimally viable products. I'm not going to go into this. I mean, a whole study pushed against minimally viable products, but I think we'll get an idea here. So when we think about minimal, this is like I said right here, crappy products nobody wants to use, okay? And then we have products built for companies that are well-financed, way more financed than you are. And we're talking about something that's kind of in the middle of that, something that's somebody would want to use, but it's not great yet. And remember, we talked about that, the adopters, because these are the guys who really want that, because that's new territory for them. They'll be the ones that'll sit there and say, you know what, if it had this, I would be happier, or you know what I'm saying, because that's how they get involved. They're very techie people, and they want to be hands-on, and they want to provide that kind of stuff. So, I've seen some pretty interesting capers in my life, to be honest with you, where literally people put together, books that are nothing but a cover, for example, nothing in between that, and, laid them out on the table and said, this is the product, and getting people interested, would you buy this kind of a thing, even though there's absolutely zero substance in it. Or one gentleman was doing a movie. He had just shot the trailer of the movie and kind of indicated he had the whole movie there and was looking at, it was kind of things to get in there just to see if people were willing to go and pay money, would you go watch this film to go off and do it? So that's what we're getting toward. So we're talking about really building experiments to see if people are willing to exchange dollars for your particular product. And like I explained the other day, it's a big difference between saying, if you build it, I'll buy it, to saying, I'll pay you money for it. All right, so the next piece we go in this, now we've kind of found some, we look at revenue streams, and again, some questions that you need to ask yourself right here, but we talk about the types. So a revenue stream may be an asset sale, so if I have a car, I literally am selling you an asset at the end of the day, but it could be a lot of other different things. It could be a usage fee. We all see about SaaS right now, where you know, you just pay, instead of buying a piece of software, you literally go online and literally you pay for the time that you use it, so that you don't end up buying that. So it could be a usage fee or subscription fees that you may want to subscribe to something, and as long as that subscription is active, you can use it as much as you want. The usage doesn't care, but you know, you're during that subscription window, you can use that. Lending or renting fees or leasing fees. Think about like Uber kind of changed a lot of the way that we kind of look at taxis in there. Licensing, that's one of the, on the oil and gas side, for example, I've developed a bunch of training materials, and instead of literally selling them the asset that they can use, I license it to them. So I say, here it is, for 1 year, for exchange of money, you can now use this as much as you want, but you know, at the end of that period, I get my asset back, unless you want to license it again for another period. Today, a lot of companies build their products like that. So they literally curate a bunch of assets. I'm talking about you in the chip world, where they license a technology and then build that into their product. Could be brokerage fees. Think about realtors. They don't really sell anything, but at the end of the day, there's a transaction and the broker gets paid. And then, of course, there's advertising. So when you think about how to create revenue for your business, try to apply this. And again, if you go to the blog, you'll see lots of more protracted discussions about each one of these different types. But here I would say, am I really selling an asset? Or could I think about maybe doing this as a licensing thing, or maybe it's a subscription thing, or see what I'm saying? A lot of times this could be the exact same type of a product. So one of the things I like to think about when I talk about this is Xerox. So if I say Xerox, what comes to mind?
Copiers,
okay. What made them different and why we think about them as copiers wasn't because they had the copiers that they sold. They changed the model. They leased copiers. So before Xerox, the only way to get a copier for your business was to buy one. They were notoriously bad in terms of staying up. So you'd end up spending $10,000 or $20,000 to buy this copier, and it would have all kinds of issues. It would take bad copies or whatever the case is. They'd bring in a technician. The technician, you have to pay the technician to fix it, or maybe had something on their short 30-day warranty period, and after that it exceeded the warranty. So these people were making money over this. So it was a lot of capital in the very beginning, and then effectively it was this maintenance thing that you had to kind of keep up with. Well, Xerox said, listen, we'll just change the model completely, and all we're going to do is we're going to say, we'll just rent it to you for, instead of you pay me $20,000, I'll just rent it to you for $1,000 a month. And with that, I'll make sure that my technician's there to tune it up once a month or whatever the case is, and make sure you've got all the supplies you need to make copies, kind of a thing. Does that make sense? I mean, all they did was they changed their revenue model by looking at saying, well, everybody else is using this model, asset sale, and I'm just going to go ahead and allow you to rent it, essentially, or lease it for a small period of time. The coffee things, the Keurig was another one. I mean, they effectively give you the pot. I mean, so if you think about Kohl's, well, Kohl's sells a coffee pot of Keurig like for $100. Keurig doesn't make any money on the coffee pot. I mean, literally, it ships from China, where they make it, to the Kohl's store, and their cost, boom, goes right out the door. And some businesses literally subsidize that to literally give you the stuff. If you think about cable TV, you don't buy that. They just give you the box, and then they have a monthly subscription. But Keurig said, listen, we're just going to sell coffee. But we're going to sell coffee that you have to buy our K-cups to put in there. You know, and then when people started cheating, then they said, we're going to put these little RF chips in there so that you can only put our K-cups in there. Do you know what I mean? To go off and do that. So does that make sense to you? So sometimes, in many cases, it's not coming up with a brand new idea. It's simply coming out with a new revenue stream to actually apply that. Very important part of the message right here. Now, We also, within addition to this, we have different types of pricing mechanisms. We'll talk a little bit about our pricing in a few minutes, but we have fixed pricing. You might have a list price, or it might be based on the product features that you buy. I mean, you always see these things, you know, bronze, silver, gold, depending on what you buy, how many pieces that you get in there, maybe some introductory type of a pricing and types of things. Customer segment dependent. I always tell people that, you know, not everybody should pay the same thing for the same price, because somebody may need it a whole lot more than somebody else. And because of that, I can actually garner more money from one customer that maybe helps subsidize another customer. And people say, well, Steve, that's not really fair, but we do this all the time. Everybody go to a store that has a military discount? Do you know what I mean? That means the people who aren't military are subsidizing the people who are military, right? In some degree or fashion. So we're literally segmenting the price based upon customer dependent. Dynamic price could be negotiated at bargaining. When you think about cars, we go in there, we don't know exactly what we're going to pay for. We have a sticker price, and we go in there, well, this is what I'm willing to pay, kind of thing. And we have this little dickering back and forth. We may have yield management types of things, or real-time marketing. These things could be like stock market, for example, and the price changes based on people going in there. What I always think about is like a pay-per-click ad. Well, I mean, that's totally dynamic, right? Because if you want to buy an ad and somebody else is bidding up the price, guess what? That price per pay-per-click goes up. If nobody's bidding on it, that price goes way down, right? So it really kind of depends. So in my oil and gas business, for example, guys are hawking interest in a well for $50,000. Their customer acquisition cost is no problem for them. They'll pay $10 per click. Well, when I sell a training product that might generate only $50 worth of sales, I can't pay $10 for a customer to click through, because that doesn't even qualify as you didn't make a purchase yet. I may have 10 people go through there. It might cost me $100 in customer acquisition costs against a $50 product. I can't compete in that space. So I can't go after that market in a pay-per-click, because other people going after that same customer segment willing to pay a lot more money than I am. So that's what we're talking about. So when we come to revenue streams, there's a lot of things to kind of think about and kind of go in there. Lots and lots of moving parts. We talk about key resources here. So think about resources. They could be physical resources that you have that to make this thing happen. So if I have a manufacturing plant, I physically have to have a plant to manufacture that in. There could be intellectual kinds of things. I might have a patent or something along that line that is my key resource that I need. And when that patent, so I meant shared originally, the story about invisible fencing really was a patent. When the patent ran out, anybody could duplicate that to kind of go out there. So it was an intellectual kinds of things, right? There's human pieces in there. So you may have, I'll give you the example too, where my company that I was working for, I was acquired because they had half the XML engineers on the planet. And it had nothing to do with their revenue or their business model or anything. It was their human people that they had there, right? And a lot of times you see these big companies, Silicon Valley companies, they literally are buying a company for an employee or two, and then they just throw away the rest of the company, to some extent, because that's what they want. And it could be financial. So in other words, you may have a key resource. I buy properties, and so that's a financial resource. Or Sears, when Sears had its financial piece in there, so then they start selling credit cards and using that to kind of build off of that. Does that make sense to you? So these are all key resources that you physically, or you have to have there, okay? Key activities, again, I won't go through the questions here, but we'll talk about, is it production? Is it problem solving? Is it a platform or network that you have? For example, if you think about Facebook, it owns a platform or network that is very hard to duplicate, because, I mean, how do you duplicate something that has, you know, essentially a billion people on it, right? So that's what some of their pieces are there to get that. I'm not going to go through this thing, but have you ever heard of the thing called iPencil? Have you seen that? It's a poem. And I should have really brought my one in there, but have you ever seen like the regular yellow pencil? It's a poem that was kind of written in there. And it really kind of gets down to the whole point that I want to make here, which is that there are lots and lots of players, lots of components and different businesses that make up one simple thing. So something as simple as that little yellow number 2 pencil with the little eraser on that you stick in a pencil sharpener and you get all the little wood chips that come out the other end. But I mean, quite literally, there are miners who mine the graphite that goes in it. There are people who build the construction equipment that allow those miners to do that. The guys who build mine the steel that go into the chainsaws that they can cut down the cedar trees that they can put them in there. The guys that, you know, produce the paint that actually uses on the outside, the people who use the glue that allows the two pieces to glue together, the people who made the equipment that actually put all this stuff together, the people who mine the steel that goes in the little thing around the thing, the rubber thing. I mean, so even at the end of the day, there's hundreds, and this poem goes on and on and on about all these different players that are involved with something as simple as a single number two pencil. So when you look at it, you have to understand there are and any one of those could break, and you could be in deep water. So if you think about a car, you know, I often have this conversation with my wife, and she says, man, I can't believe how much cars are. And I'm thinking, you know what? Cars are kind of cheap when you really think about it. Because if you back into all those different components in there, from the radios to the carburetors, to the differentials, to the tires, and, you know, all those things, to the brakes, there's millions of different components that are manufactured by all these different companies that all have to be sourced at different times, and logistics of warehousing and not having enough or too much and stuff like that. And having no tires means the production line isn't coming. You're not pumping a car out the end. So everything has to be at one particular point. So you can see how when we sit here and we start talking about key partners, how this could be really an important part to understanding how dependent you are on those. So when we talk about some of the key partners here, again, the questions here, we're talking about the motivations for the partnership. Is it to optimize or economize what they're doing, make things cheaper? Is it to reduce risk and maybe uncertainty of a particular product? Is it acquisition of a particular resource or activity that you might need to get these key partners? That'd be if you're just buying it, kind of going back to the pencil model. So then the last part of those nine blocks is the cost structures. And so we have to kind of look at it and we say, okay, is your business more what we call cost-driven? So in other words, is it lowest price of your value proposition? Is it through automation that you're trying to do that? So you're trying to keep the cost down. Walmart is a good example of cost-driven kind of a model. So everything they have is kind of designed to create the lowest amount of cost that they have versus things that are value-driven. They're focused on value creation, premium value. This might be the BMWs or the Mercedes, those kind of things that we're selling cars, for example. We're selling high-end or even the supercars, for example, where you pay incredible amounts of money for a vehicle because they're driving it from a value standpoint. Now, it could be as very simple as the difference between Dunkin' Donuts coffee and Starbucks coffee. And in lots of blind taste tests, people actually like Dunkin' Donuts coffee better than they like Starbucks coffee. But Starbucks has put itself in this value-driven kind of a model right here where it tends to focus more on a premium value than they try to get more. And name brands are always like that. So, I mean, I did a thing once on peanut butter. Well, you know, there's only a few different peanut butter manufacturers, but there's a lot of co-packing that actually occurs in there. So maybe Jiffy actually makes the same peanut butter that shows up on the shelf at King Supers. But you pay a lot more for it, a great value brand, let's say at Walmart, versus the Skippy brand. So it's the same thing, same can, same bottle, same peanuts, but it's one that spends a lot of money on brand and tries to get the value out there. And so I always think about this too when I go into McDonald's. If you part your meal a lot of times by actually buying it off a value menu, for example, you can get it cheaper than if you buy it by the numbers. So if you just say, I'd like a double patty cheeseburger, number 6 or whatever that is, with the drink and the fries, costs you more than if you bought the same thing on a value menu, but they've just made simpler things. Starbucks is a very much similar kind of a scenario there, right? Because let's face it, does it really cost a whole lot more to put a spritz of whipped cream in there or a little sprinkle of chocolate in there? I mean, it might cost them a nickel to change the profile of flavor of that particular coffee, but they might charge an extra dollar or $2 for that particular face. Does that make sense? So they're looking, we want you to define to us whether you are cost-driven or value-driven. So we're going to actually create multiple menus that allow you to do that. So within the cost structure, we also have fixed or variable costs that we have, and then which we've talked about before, salaries and rent, utilities are kind of fixed costs in a lot of cases, variable costs. We talked a little bit about that the other day. And then we have economies of scale and economies of scope. So if we're growing this and how far we reach out, if we own a whole market, then we can charge whatever we want for that. So if you're Facebook, I mean, they own it. You know what I'm saying? They own a segment in there. There's no competitors. Microsoft is another good example. I mean, they kind of own that space. There's fringy products out there, but let's face it. I mean, they own a vast majority of a piece of the market. And so from that perspective, they can get economies because they know that people can't leave and go some other places. Okay, so those are part of the cost structure. So if I can have a more of a monopolistic kind of a thing, I can go off and do that. So that's the business model canvas. There are external forces. If you go look on my blog, I will talk about external forces that fit on the outside of that. These are things like market, the age demographic kind of thing that we talked about with the Harry Dent, for example. As people kind of go through that, those might be things that might affect how you buy things. There may be industry forces that are actually occurring from technology types of things that are affecting that. I'm an oil and gas person, for example. What's going on in the Middle East affects the price of oil and gas. If there was a war in the Middle East, nobody wanted to bring their oil tankers out of there. That would drive up the price here. Nothing's happening here, but it's happening somewhere on the other side of the planet.
Thank you for listening to How to Turn My Hobby into a Full-Fledged Business. To learn more about Steve Imke, or to learn more about what it takes to own and operate a small business, please visit stevebizblog.com. That's stevebizblog.com. Or look for Steve's many books on various aspects of small business ownership at amazon.com or at stevebizblog.com.